This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about diabulimia with Lawrence Smith. I already feel like that was bad. Was that bad?
All right.
No, okay, grand. Pete, keep it, we'll continue. So first off, I've got a definition for diabulimia from diabetes.co.uk. Diabulimia is a serious eating disorder that people with type 1 diabetes can develop. It's when someone reduces or stops taking their insulin to lose weight. So that definition hopefully gives you an outline of what this is, but it can even be quite a difficult thing to describe in that diabulimia isn't a diagnosable mental illness. So whilst it's considered to be a form of eating disorder, because it has to be concurrent with diabetes, it's generally diagnosed as bulimia and type 1 diabetes as two understandably separate conditions. Although the challenge around that is it's difficult to properly treat that combination because there is so much overlap, and with one being physical health and one being mental health, often in care for one or the other, it can be missed what this overlap is. So I was really delighted to get in touch with Lawrence and be able to share his understanding of this. So yeah, first off, diabulimia, something we're still wrapping our heads around to an extent.
Absolutely. You know, to be totally honest, I'd never even heard of the term. I'd never heard of the term before. And it's got me thinking all sorts of things. Even hearing you talk then and introduce it, so complicated. And I guess, you know, in the episode, and it'll be interesting to hear, you know, Lawrence's take on it, because is one caused by the other? You know, it's a real tricky thing, actually. And although my auntie has type 1 diabetes and also has very poor mental health and is on medication for a mental health and has had psychotic episodes in the past, when she was diagnosed, which was later in life, we're already aware of her mental illness. It completely affected her mental health again, and it was all around weight, and that had never been a problem before. You know, but she lost loads of weight. She was really underweight, and she was really, really conscious about the fact that I have to watch what I'm eating, and I have to manage my sugar intake, and I have to, you know, she got really obsessive about it. You know, she was probably down to 7 stone at one point, and it was a real hard time for the family, actually, to try and support her through either the diabetes or her mental health or both together. And, this was probably about 20 years ago, so I wonder, you know, hopefully there's more support, more awareness. Obviously, this podcast is great because this episode will bring some more, even more awareness. So it must be a thing now. Well, it is. It's got a name.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
Yeah, you're right. It is great that there's a name for it and the understanding is growing. And I think even in the interview, or maybe it was after, Lawrence talks a little bit about that even since he was diagnosed with his eating disorder, he's seen the changes and how many people have heard of diabulimia. And so I do have sympathy with why it's not considered a separate diagnosis, a medical diagnosis, in that it has to be along with type 1 diabetes, a pre-existing condition. But certainly from the stats we're looking at, it's not rare. So when there's a prevalence of anything, even if it relies on the existence of another condition, then it starts to make sense that a separate diagnosis would be a route to better understanding and better treatment. Because even those of us who aren't medical have a vague understanding of certain conditions require certain treatments. We know with cancer that chemo is an element of many people's treatment. We know with eating disorders and with mental health what kind of treatments we see there. Obviously, in the episode, we'll talk a lot about insulin levels with diabetes. That really comes back to a big part of why this is so common. Because just like your aunt experienced, when your insulin levels or your sugar intake are fluctuating, and particularly when you're still learning to effectively manage your diabetes, that is going to be a big factor on weight loss or weight gain. So you're already going to have more of a focus on this like she did, and it could be easy for then that to become unhealthy.
Absolutely. And, you know, when my auntie's mental health had been stable and she'd been managing it really well, it was Christmas time and she came to visit and she'd not eaten, and obviously her blood sugar had really dropped, and mm-hmm. and her reaction and how that manifested itself was, it looked to us like she was having a psychotic episode. You know, we actually thought, oh my God, she's not been taking her meds, because she was just, you know, speaking quite, you know, nonsensical and saying really irrational things about what she was going to do or how she was feeling, and her behaviour got really out of control. And it was a real panic for us. And my mum phoned an ambulance. And when the ambulance came, we were like, you know, really trying to explain that, you know, she's not well and we think maybe she hasn't taken the medication. And the ambulance were absolutely brilliant. And the guy was so calm and he was just like, no, we see this all the time. He knew straight away she's diabetic. We were like, yeah. He said, she's having a hypo and we see it all the time. So imagine even there, the crossover. Because it's her family. She thought it was her mental health. I thought maybe she'd, you know, you'd pass out or you just became very weak. But, you know, not to the point of it really affecting your mental health. You know, really hard to watch, but a real learning, like, moment. Like, who knew that?
Right. Well, I'm so glad the ambulance crew did. It sounds like got really great support there. But I mean, we know only too well how the crossover of mental health and physical health is constant.
Yeah.
There's even an argument that separation should just be abolished because there isn't really anything you can entirely separate to one side or the other. And, you know, eating disorders are maybe one of the easiest examples of that, of how can you just focus on the mental side of it.
Or the physical.
Absolutely. And it's interesting with what you mentioned with your aunt as well about when she was diagnosed and then she was getting really worried about eating, because that's a big part of how diabulimia can slip in, because you're then reading labels more, you're really self-conscious about what you eat, you may feel even guilty for eating because you know whatever you're eating, you need to then be making calculations about your insulin levels and doing your checks for your blood pressure, your blood sugar levels. That can become like a guilty thing of like, when I eat food, I know I need to do this. And therefore, there can be a temptation to not eat. And of course, that doesn't actually help anything and that will make your diabetes worse. But I understand that it's a common temptation that you're like, you know what, I don't feel like I can do anything right.
Must be, you know, it can be a really difficult illness to manage. And we must say there are a lot of people that are really, really healthy that live with a diabetic diagnosis, type 1 and 2, and that, you know, manage it brilliantly. But yeah, for those who potentially are already maybe struggling, or those who then get a diagnosis and then, you know, it can kind of send them into a place of, like you said, obsessiveness. You know, she'll bring cakes and you go to the house and there's cakes and sugar and biscuits everywhere and you know she can't eat it. And it's worrying. It's an obsession with wanting to eat it. And then not. And it actually did make me think, bless her heart, but it did make me think when we talked about this topic, that I wonder if there's something there that with her that we've missed, actually, in terms of, you know, the signs and the beginnings of an eating disorder.
Well, indeed. And, you know, it would be a real concern, because whilst the understanding is growing, these things are often still missed. And so that's why I'm really glad to get this chance to cover this topic. And certainly it's something that I knew very little about coming into this, but you know, I'm glad that we were able to do the research and find out just how important the understanding of this is. It can be so serious for people, you know, ultimately, and medical professionals will say it time and time again, not managing your sugar levels correctly if you have diabetes can be deadly, because this is really serious. But equally, I can also see from the point of view of someone dealing with it, how you get a diagnosis like type 1 diabetes, where it is for your whole life, and you are going to have to worry about all these things that other people may not. There may even be a temptation to be self-destructive with that, that you're kind of raging against the illness. And one way to do that would be, well, fine, I'm not going to eat then. You know, I'm not saying it's healthy thinking, but then eating disorders aren't. But it can feel perhaps like something to be like, you know what, fuck it, I'm going to rebel against this. And the risk is very much there. So you found some great stats from diabetes.org.uk, which are that it's estimated 4 out of 10 women aged 15 to 30 and 1 out of every 10 young men take less insulin in order to lose weight. And so whilst in the grand scheme of eating disorders, it's not one of the more common variations, within the 300,000 people in the UK with type 1 diabetes, it's very common and very much a concern for that group.
Wow. We've discussed it a lot before on the podcast, haven't we, in terms of people who are diagnosed with a physical illness. The impact on their mental health is so significant and very rarely acknowledged, and there's not as much support available as, you know, there should be. And then, but with something like this, when there's, I guess, a level of control and responsibility that you have yourself to maintain that health, that must play even more on your mind. Because as you mentioned, other physical illnesses, you know, you have an appointment, yeah, you cannot go. You do manage it, but you know.
Yeah, it's a very...
stability.
Yeah, it's very active self-care. And I think there's an understandable level of self-respect and self-preservation you have to have to go along with that. And so for me, that's where diabetes can never just be about physical health. You know, you don't get to have a day where you're feeling bad and you don't bother to do whatever you need to do without it impacting your health. And so, of course, I think mental health is always going to be a factor with this, even if you don't experience mental ill health.
Yeah. And look at you, that was it 15 to 30 year old women?
Yeah.
You know, the prime age of caring about what you look like physically, you know, social media, the whole impact of, you know, what we look like. And then you're in a position to lose a bit of weight by not doing what I need to do, like a quick fix. You know, it's really troubling, actually.
Yeah. So we've got quite serious there, but understandably, it's a very serious topic, one we feel a lot of responsibility to cover correctly, as we've not talked about this before on the show. But I'm really delighted to be joined by Lawrence Smith, who is incredibly knowledgeable and articulate about this. He's also just a really fun person to speak to as well. So I was so delighted to get to know him. To give you some background, he is an actor and singer, originally from Scotland, now living in London. So we did a lockdown interview with him a little while ago as well, all about his experience with his career and the pandemic, how that's affected it. So with all that said, we'll get straight into the interview with him. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
So my family, there's a few cases of diabetes already running around. So when I presented with the symptoms of diabetes, it wasn't a massive shock. It was obviously incredibly upsetting and worrying for my parents on an emotional level, but it wasn't like, what is this bizarre thing? They knew what they were kind of dealing with. And so I was diagnosed when I was about 3 years old. And then a couple of months later, then my brother, he was diagnosed as well. The two kids in the household both having type 1 diabetes, it kind of became pretty normalized. You know, our injections were normalized, our having to do blood tests was normalized, having to go to the hospital for little checkups and stuff just became part of everyday life, I suppose.
So that was very normalizing. You got used to the routine of it all, checking your blood sugar levels, calculating the injection you'd need to have in terms of your insulin to keep these levels stable.
Yeah, totally. And I think my parents were very hands-on with it, because I guess they had to be, because we were just children, you know, we didn't really know much. It meant that we were incredibly reliant upon our parents to ensure our health was being maintained. Every meal was regulated, everything. If you went to a friend's birthday party, you'd have to kind of regulate how much birthday cake you had. Yeah, there had to be, you had to kind of have your eye a lot on the ball regarding food and drink.
Yeah, and it's quite an intense relationship with food and drink as a baseline for you as a child.
Sure, and as I say, at the time we were children, so we didn't really know any better. It's just kind of as we become more independent and getting into adolescence and adulthood, the control went from my parents and I took it on myself. the kind of weight of that control, it can be quite a burden. But as a child, it was just so commonplace. It just felt totally natural to us. If you have something to eat, you inject. It just made sense.
Right. But I imagine even within that, there is still an ever-present fear that you know how important it is. And I'm sure as much as your parents were very supportive, as a young person, you do pick up on their fear.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it was that something was going to go wrong. And that because you'd experience, if you're running around the playground as a wee kid, your sugar levels start to dip. Someone else, their body kicks into gear and will protect them and then bring them back out of having a low sugar episode. But for a type 1 diabetic, your body fails you in that respect. So you have to correct for it. It curbed your fun quite quickly and effectively. So it meant that you just had to play by the diabetes rule. It didn't really play by your rules.
And it's a level of vulnerability that I think for anyone is quite hard to wrap your head around.
It's as I approached adolescence and as I had, as I say, more control over my own behaviours and outlook on life, that's when I think I started to feel a lot of resentment towards diabetes. But yeah, it's as I was growing up, that's when I started to really struggle.
Yeah, and that's something I personally have a fascination in, of how as young people we are born into a reality of our household and that's all we know. And for many people, there can be a strange comfort in even the uncomfortable within that. And then it's not until you have the comparison sometimes that you see, oh, the other kids don't have to worry about this. The other kids don't have to do the injecting. And that's when you see a feeling of unfairness that before you were, for better or for worse, ignorant to.
Totally. Yeah, this might be slightly off topic, but you know, earlier on, you're learning about religion and stuff at school. And I just had this feeling of, well, if there is a God, why have I got diabetes? Which sounds a bit, I don't know, painting with quite a large brushstroke. But to kind of feel that, have I done something wrong? Am I being punished getting diabetes? And which is quite a heady thing for a 9-year-old to have to grapple with.
I think that's very understandable, though. I think that's a lot of how you're raised at that age, that there's goodies and baddies, and good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people.
Sure. Yeah. There was quite a lot to contend with. And so what I would try and do is, if I started to enter that frame of mind, like, what have I done to deserve this? I would then try and flip it and think like, okay, well, actually, what does my diabetes give me? Like, what are the pros and like, what are the pluses for this? And part of it was, you know, it meant that I was attentive, felt that I was quite present, and I felt I was a responsible little child, because just purely to get through the day, you had to be attentive and you couldn't take anything for granted, really. Just going to school and having your packed lunch or whatever, things that other kids might take for granted. You know, as a base level, my brother and I were having to, I don't know, stay alive, I guess. And so yeah, I think I was trying to find some good.
You'd learned from a young age to take ownership of your health and you were succeeding in that. And so there is a sense of pride there.
Yeah. Then when things started to go a bit awry, it was tricky. It felt almost like a betrayal in a way that I was, I said before, weaponizing the diabetes. This constant companion, in a way, the diabetes, even though it was something that was causing me a lot of strife, for me to then turn my back on it, the diabetes, it was a very inward-focused betrayal of myself. And it all got a bit complex.
Yeah, and so I'm assuming you're addressing how your mental health started to decline at this point. Do you know what kind of contributed to that initially, or where at first you had symptoms come up?
Yeah, I think, as with lots of folks, like, adolescence can be quite a tricky time. You're growing up, you're kind of having to imagine a world that is outside of the safety net that you've grown up in. You know, having to think about university and careers and stuff like that. And I think I was starting to worry about, I was trying to project myself into the future, and just there was a massive question mark there. I had no idea what my future would hold, and that was scary. And I think I really panicked. My grandfather passed away, and that was traumatic, and grappling with sexuality, stuff like that. I think there was just a lot of things were happening all at once. And in an ideal world, you know, I could have maybe just dealt with one thing at a time. It felt that so many things in my life I couldn't control, but the one thing I could control was my diabetes. as an eating disorder also emerged, that was another thing I could control as well. That gave me a sense of, amongst all this chaos, it was something that I could focus on and control.
Exactly. And whilst I wouldn't suggest that there is an easy cause and effect here, it also does make sense that when it came to you finding new coping mechanisms when you felt that you were struggling, that in a way it seems quite natural that you moved in the direction of controlling food intake as something that you'd already had years of practicing controlling it in a different way.
Yeah, it was something that I think it was my brother who said that you knew the rules of the game so well, you knew how to cheat. So yeah, because I'd established such a relationship with food over so many years, when it came to abusing that relationship, it came incredibly naturally. Instead of going down that road, I just went down that road instead, the other one. And so very quickly a neural pathway was established that was incredibly negative. And it fostered a lot of continued resentment against the diabetes because I felt the diabetes got in the way of my eating disorder. Because, not to be too dramatic, but with anorexia, you know, you're effectively starving yourself. You can't do that as a diabetic. It would just cause horrendous health complications very quickly.
Right, because that's something people may not understand if they don't know much about diabetes, that in many ways it can have huge complications, but at its core it's actually quite a straightforward condition in that you've got a level of normal for your blood sugar and your body isn't able to regulate that in the way other people's would.
Totally.
And
absolutely.
So if you fall outside of that, there's these kind of buffers where, like, if you had too much sugar or if you have too little sugar, you will get unwell very quickly. And so that very quickly will put a sort of hard stop maybe on certain eating disorder behaviours.
Totally, yeah. Things that would almost be like disassociate. I would go through periods of just trying to not eat anything, or periods of, I guess, intense binging as well and stuff like that. And when in the eating disorder persona, I'd almost forget that I did that in a way, just because it felt like someone else was doing that. You know, when the eating disorder voice was very loud, it felt that I wasn't in control of that stuff. And then 10 minutes later, your diabetes reminds you that, yes, Lawrence, you did do that, because your body then reacts. So the eating disorder was my brain, but the diabetes was my body. So the two of them were kind of fighting against each other. So if I wanted, for example, to run for hours on end, whatever, for the anorexia, what would then happen is then the diabetes would then, I would then have a hypo, which meant that my blood sugar levels would drop dangerously low. So to combat the hypo, you need to eat and ingest sugar. But then that meant that the anorexia lost because the diabetes won. You know, so it was quite a tricky little battle that was going on within me.
No, absolutely. I can see that. And it's something where I can see how internal that would have been, the temptation to try and hide these coping mechanisms, because even the unhealthy coping mechanisms we can be very protective of, because you don't know what else to do. You're like, this is me coping, this is how I'm getting through my day. And I think somewhere in you, once you've got a certain awareness, you know that it's unhealthy and that people would be justified in trying to stop you taking certain behavior. But then you had the additional, this thing that is already pre-existing, is already a massive part of who I am, that is also seemingly interfering. Even though it's not, you know, sentient, it's not something I can get rid of.
Sure, sure. And, you know, it's incredibly dangerous. Like, I think the short-term effects of diabetes, that, you know, you might feel a bit unwell, or you get dizzy, or you get nauseous, or your legs, you might be really shaky and sweating profusely, and you feel very confused and discombobulated. Those are the short-term effects, but it's the long-term effects that are scary. And maybe when I was 3 years old in 1990, whatever, and our doctor was trying to talk to us about diabetes, maybe they didn't want to front load all this nasty information on parents, but it's stuff like heart attacks and increased risk of blindness and amputations and all these things that when you're a teenager you don't really think about. You think that's going to happen to someone else, but it's a scary thought that if your diabetes control is good, then you get all the rewards of that, you know, you feel healthy. But if your diabetes control isn't good, then you get that as well. You get all those effects. You feel terrible. And then that is an added burden, but it's also a sense of shame. Like, oh God, I'm fucking up at even being a diabetic. You know, it's just there's a lot of, I don't know, a lot of stuff to contend with all at once.
Well, for you, your health is more immediately vulnerable in a way that most people's isn't. So, you know, yes, there are unhealthy behaviours we could all do that could lead to some pretty serious consequences. But, you know, that's not looming over us in the same way. And we wouldn't really have the short term thing. You know, someone could go through their whole life having a bad relationship with their sugar level, for example. They could just be overeating for a lifetime. In the short term, there's not as dangerous effects. It's more the long term. But, you know, also like we talked about, you had those years of soaking up the fear of loved ones as well as your own fears.
Yeah, it's quite a lot. What I would eventually start doing, this is just kind of what the phrase diabulimia. So it's funny, it's not actually an actual recognized medical term. It just seems to be a terminology that has been adopted. But it's some who...
There is a very long word that is considered, a very long string of words that is considered the more technical one, but diabulimia really is what it says on
seems
the term.
Just seems to tick that particular box quite swiftly. It's essentially, the mismanagement or abusal. The mismanagement of insulin intake in order to control weight. Because what happens is if your blood sugar levels go high for a prolonged amount of time, the body tries to just flush out as much as it can, just flush out as much of the excess sugar. And so you're going to the toilet a lot and you're basically peeing a lot. And that's what happens when your body's struggling with an excess of sugar. And in a prolonged hyper state, the body tries to break down all this excess sugar that is found, and it breaks down fat and muscle and organs to try and combat all this excess sugar, which all sounds incredibly technical. Maybe it doesn't, I don't know. But essentially, the short form, what it means is that even just by sitting on the couch, if I had high sugar levels, I am losing weight because my body was breaking down, which is an incredibly dangerous, that's incredibly dangerous, A, but it's a dangerous mindset to be in as someone with an eating disorder, someone who has had a fixation with weight, that if I actually take this diabetes, I can actually use it. So I would continue with my exercise and I would continue with starvation periods, but I just wouldn't inject. So it meant that my blood sugar levels were constantly running in a high and in a really dangerous level, so that when I did exercise or if I did inject occasionally, rather than bringing me into a healthy level, it would just kind of dip me a little bit from this dangerously high level. So plus side in terms of an eating disorder meant I was losing weight easily. Fantastic. Bad side was that it was ravaging my internal organs and everything. And I felt like shit permanently for about 3 years. But when you convince yourself, when you're in a dangerous position, you know, you don't really care about, or I personally didn't care about the long-lasting effects of this. I cared about right now, and at that moment it seemed to be helping me.
Yeah, well, it was the thing that felt like it was helping you cope, even though actually it was just creating problems in a different area.
Yeah, incredibly compromised.
And one of the reasons why I particularly wanted to cover this with you is because I think certainly for me and many people that have experienced eating disorders, we can understand the temptation in that. It's like you're looking for hacks, that you're like, if there's this one thing I can eat or this one change to my diet that I can lose weight, but maybe I'll get away with it. People won't realize. Or maybe I'll lose weight faster, or people exercising. It's like, well, maybe, you know, those around me are getting really worried about what I'm eating. So a way for me to continue this behavior and hide it further is I go and exercise more. And exercise is held up as a healthy thing in our society. So maybe I'll get away with that. And so as unhealthy as it is, I can easily understand how you saw, oh, if I don't do this, then I'm going to lose this weight. Like, it seems like a cheat.
Yeah.
And so maybe you try not to think about the longer term stuff. Because you're trying to cope today.
Yeah, it's quite intoxicating in a way, but in a negative mindset.
And that's why I'm really glad that there is a term that puts that together, because from what I know of your experience, there was a lot of mismatching. The people that were there for your physical health understood that side. The people that were there for your mental health didn't see how that linked to the physical.
Totally. Because I felt for the longest time that I sucked at even having an eating disorder, because I was like, well, I am eating occasionally, but I thought people with eating disorders don't eat, blah, blah, blah. You know, I had lots of inaccurate ideas of what an eating disorder looked like or was. And I think because I felt like I couldn't be a successful anorexic, air quotes, because of the diabetes. But so then learning that actually there is this term where there is this classification of eating disorders with diabetes at the forefront. I can't speak to my past self, you know, whether that would have made a difference. But looking back now, I perfectly fit within the remit of diabulimia. And not everyone finds labeling useful or positive, but I think it is a great place to start, at least, to then tackle the issues. Because, yeah, I think whenever I was introduced to a new mental health team, because the diabetes was slightly uncharted territory for them, they would deal with the anorexia and depression and self-harm, but the diabetes, they weren't as associated with it.
Really interesting, and it's such a tricky one because on one hand, it's completely understandable. Of course, the specialism of mental health professionals is mental health. But like we find so often on the podcast, there are all these links. And another one you're making me think about is with your experience of depression as well, to what degree your fluctuating sugar levels, thus affecting your mood, thus affecting your depression, was also a link.
Totally. You know, a natural side effect of having diabetes is you're continually having to consider your own mortality in a way, you know, that it's a very small leap for someone with diabetes to go from being healthy to be very unhealthy very quickly. That is quite a burden to carry with you every day of your life. So yeah, fluctuating sugar levels, absolutely. I mean, I can be an absolute shit when my sugar levels aren't in a good place, mood wise. So it would absolutely have a knock on effect.
And was there a key point when things started to improve, or was it more gradual with the support you got?
I think it was gradual. I think it wasn't a case of, oh, I got diagnosed with an eating disorder and then from that day onwards I was absolutely A-OK. It was very much a, you know, I got diagnosed and that, not to be horribly cliched, but that's when the journey began. Because I was also, you know, living my life and everything that comes with that. You know, you get hurdles in any shape and form, yeah, they have to contend with irrespective of the eating disorder, the diabetes. So I think it was a gradual thing. I think it took many, many years, and I'm not in any way saying that I currently have perfect mental health or perfect relationship with my diabetes or perfect relationship with eating. Not at all. I've got very deeply ingrained behaviors and thought patterns, which, you know, I try and deal with as best as I can. But I think it took, for me personally, it just took years of just, I think, getting to know, this sounds horrible, but getting to know me a little bit better. I think I spent so many years attributing personality traits or sense of identity on the diabetes and on the anorexia that I kind of lost a little bit of Lawrence in the shuffle. And so I think it's just been the ongoing process of just getting to know who I am a little bit better, divorced from the mental health stuff, that's helped me get out of it.
I think that's really fascinating because for each of us, we have to have our own journey with that, to what degree we take on mental illness as part of who we are. Because, you know, if you consider it like two extremes, at one extreme, it's this is how I am. I'm always going to be depressed. Nothing's ever going to change. Why bother keep living? And then perhaps on a different extreme, I could draw, there's people that never accept it, or, you know, feel that it's entirely something that happened to them, in the same way you might trip and you get hurt because of that. You wouldn't find any reason to draw, okay, how could this relate to other things in my life? You just trip.
Sure.
You know, and so...
Yeah.
And so it's interesting hearing how you had to grapple with that as well.
Yeah, and I'm fully aware that I'm speaking from a position right now of being okay. Like, currently, touch wood, I am in a good place with my mental health and stuff. There have absolutely been times in my life when it has felt incredibly unmanageable, and it has felt at points, you know, there's been some incredibly dark moments. And I think it sounds way too easy, but yeah, I felt that I didn't feel that I was interesting enough or funny enough or smart enough or anything enough. But I think I felt that the only thing that was remarkable or outstanding about me was how ill I was. And I think it's just trying to take moments to take stock and kind of be like, well, that's not all you are. The eating disorder is not all that you are. And the diabetes is not all that you are. It's part of you. It absolutely is it is part of you, but it's not all that you are. And I think that that's been a way for me to try and get better.
And when you look back on it now, can you see maybe a tracing back where, because so often people that were looking out for you were very focused on your diabetes from a young age, do you feel that then was part of how it became your identity in that way? You'd get praised for managing it well, and people would worry about you if you were not managing it well. And so that very much ended up at the forefront of how people perceive you.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that's a massively interesting thought. Yeah, it was never a case of, oh, if I had a hypo, then my parents would be angry with me or anything like that at all. But I think it was very much, it was an inbuilt thing of like, if I've mucked up somehow, then it's my fault. It was a bit tricksy. I hadn't considered that before. That was interesting.
Well, I wonder, to give you maybe the flip side perspective on that, in a way the diabetes gave you an advantage in understanding mental health to an extent, because you'd grown up living with something that you would need to, for want of a better phrase, be on your guard about for your whole life. And so then even with going through recovery for your eating disorder or for your depression, then you're not going to default to thinking, okay, I'm fixed now. Instead, your approach to health in general has been set up as health is an ongoing process. There is not a fixed health and a broken health. And therefore, with your mental health, you understood perhaps, I need to keep working at this.
That's correct. Yeah, I think, yeah, because it's an ongoing thing. It doesn't just go away. It's just something that has to be checked in on every so often. And I think, yeah, I guess with the diabetes, when it's done well, it's almost invisible in a way. It's just part of day-to-day life. It's when something goes wrong, that's when you really notice it. And I think maybe that's true as well for mental health. It's when it flares up, that's when it becomes dangerous and scary and whatever. But that doesn't mean a good day is just a good day. A good day is a good day because you've worked hard to make it a good day. And that's true for diabetes, I personally, as it is for me personally with my mental health as well. And you know, and if things are going a bit badly, I tend to want to blame myself and be really down on myself. Useful to just to be a bit kinder to yourself.
Absolutely. No, I think that's something, you're making a silly face, but I think that's something.
Don't tell them that. They don't need to know that.
No, I've outed you. But no, I agree with your point that that's something we all need to work on. That yes, it's not fun and it's not a flashy, altruistic thing to get better at self-love. But that doesn't mean it's not important. And also, it doesn't mean that it's self-centered, because you having a good relationship with yourself very much informs the relationships you have with everyone else.
Yeah, absolutely. It allows you to integrate with society a lot better than... Yeah, it's all quite a steep learning curve, isn't it?
Absolutely. And so we'll start wrapping up then. In terms of... I know, didn't that go quick?
So nope. Because I've stopped and started, no.
Now you're telling the listeners that this is our second take. They didn't need to know that.
They didn't need to know that. Damn it. This is going so well.
So to start wrapping up then, you know, you talked about having good and bad days. What are the kind of things you work on day to day now to manage your mental health?
First thing that comes to mind is to not punish myself or to not be negative on myself. Being a functioning member of society, I personally find it incredibly hard. I don't want to speak on behalf of other folks, but it's tricky sometimes. So I think if I slightly, to use a phrase, fall off the wagon or anything like that, I don't just sweep it under the rug and go, oh, well, never mind. I kind of look at it and kind of go, okay, well, that has happened. Why did that happen? How can I make sure that doesn't happen again? Or how can I be a bit kinder to myself? If I'm feeling crap, or if I exercise too much, or try and skip a meal, or have a fixation on food, or have bad control of my insulin intake, rather than just kind of going and being incredibly negative, no one wins in that situation. Just take a little bit of time and kind of go, okay, well, something has happened. What can I learn from this? And that's what I try and do.
Because if nothing else, if you were writing yourself off as some kind of failure every time that happened, that doesn't really make any sense in the long term. Because
totally.
Yes, you may have not manage things as well as you want to today, but there are so many other days to live.
Yeah, it would just get very overwhelming if you're that mean to yourself. So yeah, I try and be kind to myself.
Yeah, certainly with my experience of being better at being kind to yourself and giving yourself a break. And sometimes I just need to have a day off for my mental health, and it is what it is. But yeah, it's better I do that than I try and plow through sometimes and make myself worse. And then in many ways, I'm then accountable for that too. I'm accountable for then making my mental health worse.
Sure, absolutely. What's the whole thing about if you've got like a watering can and there's, and you're trying to, I'm not even going to.
Oh no, that's the one. I know what you mean. I've heard all the phrases. That one's self-care. A lot of people use it for you can't fill from an empty jug kind of idea.
That's it. A watering can, that's kind of a thing, isn't it? I don't know.
Yes. I mean, we could link it into the metaphor of the flower heads on our artwork.
Yes, okay.
We've actually never talked about it on the podcast, but that's what that is for. It's a metaphor for mental health.
And if nothing else, listeners, no other reason for listening to this episode than to find out the source of the logo. That's kind of cool.
Well, it was something that I was like, I don't really want to address it. I'm like, I want people to figure out the metaphor for themselves. It's healthy minds, and the plants are a visual representation of that.
That's cool. Do you have any tattoos? This is a sidetrack.
I think that's maybe something for another podcast. I don't.
That's fair. Okay. Yeah, no, fair. No, me neither. Yeah, okay, good.
I don't think I'd ever be able to decide, quite honestly.
No, yeah, I change my mind far too frequently. Yeah.
Grand. So on that somewhat random note, we will wrap up.
Oh, I forgot we were recording. Good idea.
So we'll wrap up there. Is there anything last thing you want to say? Is there anything you want to promote to the listeners?
Not particularly. I just think that if it does at any point start to feel a bit overwhelming, there are plenty of places to look out for support, as like Beat and Diabetes UK.
And so thank you so much for joining us.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
I'm going to promote something on your behalf, which is that you wrote a brilliant article about diabulimia, which I'd recommend, and certainly made my job of researching for this episode a lot easier to get a real background. So if people want to learn more about your experience, I'll put a link for that in the episode description.
Very sweet. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Grand. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.